A reading from the prophet Daniel. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon, and then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the province gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, languages, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I've set up? Now if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated, and he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fire furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." The word of the Lord.
Well, it is so good to be with you. If I've never met you before, I'm just so glad to be here. I do feel like I always get to be at Emmanuel on sunny days. So I have a very sunny feeling this morning. But I'm thrilled to go through this passage. Thank you, Bill, for reading it. That was no short passage today. But this is one of those dynamic stories that fills and shapes our imagination. My family, one of our favorite stories is when my wife, Sarah, looked at my daughter, Eliana, when she was three at the time, and she was recognizing that she was beginning to have this beautiful imagination. And so she actually went to her, this little three-year-old, and she said, "Eliana, you have such a beautiful imagination." And Eliana responded, "An imagination? I'm not sure I have an imagination, but I can pretend I do." And this morning, we're going to look at this story, and I want to invite you to get into that imaginative space where you can actually enter in with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and you can bring yourself into that story. By doing so, that imagination will shape you, and it will form you. And if you don't feel like you have a very good imagination, then just pretend like you do for this morning. But we begin with looking at the story at the character of Nebuchadnezzar. This character who's famous in ancient history, along with just famous in the Bible. King Nebuchadnezzar was the second emperor in the Neo-Babylonian Empire. Nabopolassar, his father, sent him out on these long military campaigns that he continued when he ascended into the throne. And he ransacked cities like Ashkelon and Gaza and famously Jerusalem and basically every city from the Mediterranean Sea to the Persian Gulf. But he not only was interested in this military campaigns, he was very interested in these building projects and in what could happen with all this money coming back to his capital city in Babylon. So he put that money to work. But you can imagine as things are going up and to the right for Nebuchadnezzar, he was having some significant problems. He was trying to take the best and the brightest from all these cities where he took from and bring them to Babylon to be able to get his best leaders with the highest EQ and IQ on the job, but all these leaders come from different cultures and ethnicities that have long-standing hatred and animosity towards each other. So how is he going to unify them? And also, he's got a ton of money, but how is he actually going to get that money to work? How is he going to find these leaders well who'll be able to do the job? And we also know from ancient sources that Nebuchadnezzar, he was a really good leader. Like Nebuchadnezzar is one of those rare people in history who's actually the heir to the throne, but also a very, very good leader in and of his own right. And so the way that he would actually choose his leaders from the provinces is he knew the only way to establish lasting peace in this new empire is if he found leaders in these far off provinces away from this capital city of Babylon who looked and sounded and kind of were of the culture of their own people. So he had his leaders who were coming from the diversity that now was this new empire. And how is he going to bring the best and the brightest together in Babylon to have them work together? What we see here is right in the beginning of this story. It says that he took them out to the plain of Dura, which all that we know about the plain of Dura is that it was a really flat place. No idea where it is, but it was really flat. It was a plain. And that was important because he built a really tall thing there. It says he built an image of gold that was 90 feet high and 9 feet wide. It's like a third of the size of the Statue of Liberty. And he overlaid that in gold. Now, no one could do that at the time but Babylon. No one could do that but someone who just took all the gold from the temple in Jerusalem and from every other city in kind of their area. He had all the best architects at his disposal. He had this entire new empire, and he needed a new image. Why? Well, what's this new image? A lot of people, there's a lot of fun debate. If you ever want to read commentaries on what's this image, you can go down a long rabbit trail. Is it Nebuchadnezzar himself? Is it him just having an egotistical fun time building up an image? Or is it his favorite god, Marduk? Or is it a bunny? Forgive me for that. I told myself, anyways, I'm just going to keep going. The point is, it actually doesn't matter what the image was. What Nebuchadnezzar was doing in this moment was he knew he's building a new empire, and so what he needs is new branding. He needs something new that will gather all of his people together. The image represents Babylon and restoring the ancient glory of Babylon. He was seeking to build Babylon 2.0. And so he built up this huge image on this really flat place so that all of these leaders who are gathered together, speaking different languages, wearing different dresses, wearing the different customs that they have, would all fall on their faces before this image that unifies them around Nebuchadnezzar's plans for the empire. I mean, just imagine being there. Like how this, if you were there, this is like a iconic event. So the thing that you tell your kids and grandkids about, like the buzz in the air as you saw everyone else with you, as you heard the music of the lyre and the trigon and the harp and the bagpipe, and as you saw this thing that no one else had built something like this before, and you fell on your face. But people bowed. And why was it that people bowed when they saw this image? You know, was it because they really thought that this was a new divine being in their midst? And very likely the answer is yes. Some of them really felt like there was this divine power behind this new image. But why people bowed, I think, has a lot more to do not with the image in and of itself, but what that image could give them. What Nebuchadnezzar is doing is he's saying, now, if you're going to make it in Babylon, this new symbol of what we're trying to build, the Babylon 2.0, this is what your life needs to be about. If you want to get that promotion, you need to make your life around Babylon 2.0. You need to get with the program. And so if you wanted to move up in society, if you wanted your dreams to be fulfilled, then you would follow through and worship this image. We also know people bowed because of what this image could do to them, right? Nebuchadnezzar has a herald proclaim aloud, anyone who does not fall down and worship shall be thrown into a burning, fiery furnace. Now, when we as leaders are trying to motivate people, we can use carrots or we can use sticks. And Nebuchadnezzar here is taking a bunch of sticks, throwing them into a fire and saying, that's where you'll be if you don't fall down and worship, which is an effective stick. And I just want to name, this is evil. In fact, in Revelation, when John is seeing his visions, Babylon is the archetype of evil. Because just like Babel, Babylon is a human nation seeking to build something big and great without the presence of God or any dependence on the living God. So everyone bows, but three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And some of the Chaldean, that is the majority culture, the Babylonians, men, saw that there were these three men who were standing up. And not only there were three men who were standing up, these three men were three men who were Jewish leaders specifically promoted by Nebuchadnezzar. In the chapter earlier, Daniel had rightly interpreted a dream by Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar, as a reward, promoted Daniel and with him Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so these three Babylonians, or not these three Babylonians, I just feel like there should be three, but these Babylonians come and they basically tell on Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in a racistly driven charge because of their jealousy. It says, you, O king, do you notice something? Do you notice that you said when we see the image and when we hear the music, we're supposed to fall down? Because we heard you when you said that. Actually, we even remember the six specific type of instruments, which were repeated four separate times in that passage. And not only do we remember the six specific types of instruments, we remember King Nebuchadnezzar, oh, wonderful, wise, perfect, handsome king. We remember your punishment is that you should throw them into a fiery furnace. And Nebuchadnezzar at this point is filled with rage, right? You can imagine that Nebuchadnezzar is feeling, you know, I promoted these men. Like I actually stuck my neck out for them. And if this is how my friends treat me, but he's a really good leader. Like when Nebuchadnezzar is known as a good leader, and shows that here because he actually is able to put down his anger and he's able to give them a second chance. Why is he giving them a second chance? Well, because Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are exactly what he needs. They are high EQ, high IQ leaders who come from a far off province who can help him build Babylon. And so he says, okay, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, maybe you didn't hear me. I mean, there was a lot of people there. Like it was a big event. Remember how big that event was? Maybe you were just standing far in the back. Maybe you didn't hear me. So I'll just tell it to you again. When you hear this music and when you see this image, you need to bow down. But importantly, what he says at the end is, and who is the God who will deliver you out of my hand? We sing is, look, I know you guys aren't fools. I know you're smart. I've seen a lot of religious zealots before, and religion has its place. For Nebuchadnezzar, he did a lot with religion. He was incorporating in religion from all over the empire. He knew it was really important to have a vibrant religious life, incorporating multiple different religious backgrounds. He said, I know you guys aren't foolish, but just here's the thing. Okay, Babylon now is the most important thing to you. And if you can just level with me, I've got a sword, I've got an army, and I've got a really hot fire. And just think for a second, what God that you bring is more real to you than that? And how are Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego going to respond? You know, how are they going to respond? They used to live in Jerusalem. They used to live where the institutions of the day supported their religion. And now they've gone to Babylon. How is it that they're going to respond? If you want to turn with me in your bulletins there, we'll start at verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. They respond by not responding. But they're also really respectful to the archetype of evil, to a guy who maybe just built an image of himself. They're respectful. And it's important to note, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are not culture warriors seeking a fight. Right? They're actually the ones brought before the king. They didn't seek out this battle. And this totally makes sense because they're part of the exiles who actually received the letter from Jeremiah. It's Jeremiah chapter 29, where God tells the exiles who had gone off early into Babylon how they are to respond in this evil culture. And what are they supposed to do? Supposed to build houses and live in them. They're supposed to marry and give their sons and daughters away in marriage. They're supposed to seek the prosperity of the city because these exiles in this evil place, their prosperity, their lives are tied to the prosperity of Babylon. Build gardens, plant roots, right? These three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, are deeply embedded in Babylon society. Like they're a part of the institutions. They're seeking her good. I think this is so important for us to remember. The last thing I would want you to hear as I preach on this is, hey, look, our culture is evil, which I do think our culture is filled with the evil of Babylon. But our culture is evil. Therefore, let us go to battle against it. As Christians who really identify with the theme of exile, we know the call of exiles is not to turn away from society, but to turn towards her and serve her. Right? When we gather at church every Sunday, we don't bash our politicians. We pray for them. We ask God on their behalf. Right? We don't pick up fights with people to prove that we're right. We pick up towels seeking where can we serve and bless. But these men are turned towards Babylon to bless her. But equally, this story shows us that Babylon is evil. And if we're going to live in a culture this side of the Lamb's reign, we know we are going to encounter evil. And when you encounter evil, you are going to have image of gold moments where you'll be forced to choose between losing your integrity or losing out. So they continue and they say, if this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. O king, we have no need to answer you in this matter because there is something more real than your sword, your army, and your furnace. And we're not going to answer you because you're not actually questioning us. You're questioning our God. It's not actually our fight, it's his. He will deliver us. But if not, Like that part is actually printed. They say, but if not. Just staggering. Saying our God will deliver us, but he also might not. He has the ability to deliver us. It would just be like him. Every time a foreign leader actually insults the integrity of God, God seems to show up. This is exactly the time that we would imagine he would deliver us, but I'm not him. I'm not making his decision. It's so important that as Christians, we don't presume upon God. He is God. He's different than us. Presuming upon God by saying, God's going to bring this healing for me. God will provide this job for me. God will keep this person who I so need, he will keep them from death. And that's not a sign of great faith. It's a sign of immature faith. But it can come from a really great heart, believing in God's power, but it can lead to an unnecessary faith crisis because it forgets the fundamental reality that God is his own person who has his own will and his ways and his thoughts are different and are higher than ours. And yes, God in his mystery, he does respond to our faith. But it's still ultimately his choice and his decision. We don't presume upon God, even in distress. But we could ask him. Right, mature faith is saying, God, I need you. God, I need you to show up here right now in this situation. Would you show up? I know you can deliver me. I know you will deliver me, but if not, Father, take this cup from me. Yet not as I will, but as yours be done. But if not, be it known to you, O King, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. O King, our God is real. He will deliver us, but if he doesn't, we're still not going to bow. I'm still not going to follow that image. I'm still not going to declare that that's the most important thing in my life. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego resolved that the cost of bowing down was greater than the cost of standing up. Their integrity was more important than their life. They feared God more than the fire. And we get this. They're not tempted to worship the image of gold because they think all of a sudden, look, Nebuchadnezzar just built a new God who let's just worship him. That's awesome, Nebuchadnezzar. No, they know that Yahweh God is the only God. What they're tempted to do is for a moment to just pretend like they can go along with everyone else so that they can see their wives again. And so that they can actually raise their kids. I bet they feel like, is it selfish for me to just, can't I just do a little thing for this so that my kids will actually have a dad? I bet they also don't want to be in a 1,000-degree burning oven. So maybe God would just understand. He knows I don't mean it. But they resolved that their integrity was more important than any of that. Where is there a battle for your integrity right now? Where is a golden image moment for you? Do not bow down. If that just sounds like a, I don't know, an unpractical idea, maybe that's not something you're faced with right now. I want you to resolve this one thing from this story. If you are ever asked what you believe, I'm saying about Christianity, yes, but also just whatever you're asked about what you believe, don't lie. Resolve not to lie, even if there's a consequence. For when it's lose your integrity or lose out, Christians, we lose out every time. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed, which is terrifying. You imagine him with a crown on his head, with a scepter, a sword, with all his robes and an army behind him in a burning fiery furnace, and he's mad, and he's in front of you. And he ordered the furnace to be heated 7 times more than it was usually heated, which is just a way to say as hot as it can get. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army rangers, to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. He does unleash the power of the image upon Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. But if this is God's battle now, how is God going to respond? If Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say this, it's actually now for us to respond. Now is the point in the story where we see how will God act.
But
then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. How does God act? He lets them get thrown into the fire. He allows trial, suffering, and loss for those whom he loves and who have stood up for him. Peter writes, "Do not be surprised, beloved, at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you." Last year on Palm Sunday, I was just finished up our Palm Sunday service, and I was about to teach a discipleship class. About like 20 people left in the sanctuary at Trinity. And I checked my phone and I saw that 30 minutes prior, I had a text from my neighbor. I live in a townhome. My neighbor, Ben, texted me and he said, there's a fire on your kitchen dining room table. And then later he texted me, firefighters got it all out. You're good. So I asked someone else to leave the class and I went back to my house and I saw that there indeed was a fire. Thankfully, no one was hurt. No other homes were damaged. But every single item in my house needed to be either thrown away or replaced. We had to obviously move, and we moved into my parents' house, who were gracious to have us live there in Oak Park, which we call our Babylonian palace because it's both exile and it's nicer than our actual house. And we're still out. We haven't gone back in our house yet. Last week, we celebrated, it was April 2nd, our 1 year anniversary of the fire. Sarah and I decided, how are we going to celebrate it? Let's go out to sushi together. And so we went out to sushi. We told our waitress, we're celebrating 1 year of a fire in our house. She said, what a great reason to celebrate. I was like, I don't think you heard us at all. And then we ordered whatever items on the menu both felt like the fire. We had our Oak Park Cosmopolitan drink, and we had the Chicago Fire roll, which was on point, but a terrible roll of sushi. And I say all of that to name that the image of trials being fiery has really hit home for me this year. A couple months into this, I was meeting with my spiritual director on Zoom, Doug. And Doug was listening to me talk, and for about 20 minutes, he said, Nate, it seems like you've been talking a lot about the fire and how that's affected you. I was like, thanks, Doug. I just want to pause and notice that. You always want to pause and notice the most painful parts of my life, Doug. And he said, in every fire, you always lose something. And it's important to stop and to mourn and grieve. And in every fire, you're always being refined. And it's important for you to look at that and notice it and accept it and thank the Lord for it. What have you lost? Where are you being refined right now? God gives his beloved trials, fiery trials. And he doesn't save Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from the fire. He saves them in the fire. And there is real loss in our lives. The death of a loved one, the anguish of infertility, the ripping apart of a friendship, the losing of a job, a mental health crisis, right? A physical ailment where our bodies aren't responding how they once did. Don't be surprised when you experience loss. It's not a sign that you're forsaken. It's what God allows for his beloved. The life of his anointed one was a life of loss. So there's always a loss to mourn in what trial you're in, just as there always is refinement. A couple months ago, we were pretty close to actually moving back into our house, they opened up just a part of our wall. They found more soot in our second floor, and that was the only part that they hadn't absolutely demoed. And so they had to absolutely demo our second floor, and when they demoed our second floor, they saw that our roof also was leaking actively and was causing, you know, going to mold up there. So we need to replace our roof. I say that to say it's 4 more months now before we move in. And sometimes when it comes to refinement, we can go quickly to refinement and spiritualize away our loss and not have time to actually grieve the loss that we have. But sometimes refinement is just so obvious and so plain. And it's an invitation from the Lord. Because you know what's more important for me than getting back into my home with our family? Me learning the virtue of patience. Patience is more precious than any comfort in this world. Which if you want to just tell me that anytime, you can tell me that. If you have my number, text me that. Patience is more precious. Well, how is God purifying you? And where is his invitation? He's not punishing you. He doesn't hate you. He loves you. How does God act to his beloved? Is he allows trials, he allows loss, and he shapes us in it. Continuing our story, it says, because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed the men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In those furnaces in Babylon, most likely, you would go up a small hill and there was a large opening at the top. And there was also a small opening at the bottom. At the small opening at the bottom, you could just kind of move around the wood. But at the large opening at the top, that's where you would just throw in large pieces of wood. And so these army rangers are going to take in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Instead of throwing in wood, they're going to throw the people in. But the army rangers themselves, they actually fire so hot that they perish. And it says, these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. They're helpless, fully clothed, fully bound. And then it says, King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, did we not cast three men into the fire? Where Nebuchadnezzar goes to the bottom to that little opening and he looks around and he's astonished. Didn't we have three guys? They answered and said to the king, true, O king. And he answered and said, but I see four men unbound walking in the midst of the fire and they're not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. He is astonished, not primarily because they're alive, but because there's another man with them, a son of God. And this must be the God that they were talking about. And he's real and he's there. And he's astonished, for as one pastor puts it, because no God saves like this, where he joins them in the fire, where he joins them in the furnace. Now, I don't know exactly what trial you are experiencing. And I don't know exactly what God will do for you, but what I do know is where God is. He is with you. He is with you in your loss and in your pain and in your trial. No God saves like this. I had the privilege a few years ago of going to the Netherlands and visiting an Iranian house church planting movement. And there were a few, six different Iranian house churches among the Persian diaspora that were in the Netherlands. And I stayed in the home of one of the pastors. His name was Vahik, with his wife, Sonia. And they made me incredible saffron rice. And they treated me with this warm hospitality in their small two-bedroom apartment. But one day we sat on the couch and he actually served me Turkish coffee. And Vahik, a man like in his late 30s, was looking at me in the eyes and telling me a story of how he first got thrown into prison in Iran, and then how he was thrown into prison for his ministry and for his work of being a pastor, and they found him out. He was thrown into prison, and he was newly married to Sonia, and they were separated immediately in the prison, and he was put in a cell by himself, and he didn't know if his wife was alive. And for 10 months, he didn't see anybody. He was interrogated. He had food. But all he did was he stayed in that cell. And he said, every single morning, I woke up and for 2 hours, I prayed. I prayed for God to deliver me. I prayed for my wife, Sonia. I prayed for the church in Iran that was happening. And I prayed and I prayed and I prayed. And after 2 months, I stopped praying because absolutely nothing happened. And he told me then the story of how he stayed being a Christian. He just stopped feeling God and stopped wanting to pray. And there was kind of a miracle of deliverance. He actually was released from prison. His wife, Sonia, was released with him. They were able to go through Turkey and then eventually be placed in the Netherlands. And they were able to have a son. His name was Roderick. Roderick was 3 at the time when we were staying with him. And well over coffee, then he looked at me and he told me how when Roderick was just 1 year old, he would wake up like six times in the night. The first time in this story I can really identify with Ahi. And every time he would wake up and he would just scream, and it was his duty as the dad, the way they split it up, where he would be the one who would pick him up and he would rock him and he would sing to him, and then he would fall asleep and put him back. This was happening night after night. He was going a little bit crazy, insane, as some of you know. And one night he woke up in the night and he heard two voices. He heard the cry of his son, Roderick, and then he heard the word Vahi. And he got up out of bed and he started walking to his son, and he just said, yes. He said, Vahi, do you hear your son? Vahi felt like he knew it was the Lord speaking to him. And he also was like, yes, I hear my son. He said, Vahi, do you think I did not hear you every morning when you cried out to me? So he just then picked up his son and he held him and he sang to him and he just wept. The truth of this passage is that you may not always feel it, but God is always with you. And one day, certainly the last day, he'll reveal right where he was and just what he was doing. Our God loves you. He loves you and he allows trials and he allows pain and he allows loss and he refines in it. He is with you and he is worthy of your worship, of your integrity, and of your devotion. In the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit.